Also, you get soft. You're not on the qui vive. You develop flabby muscles because you never get involved in a fight. And so gradually, the successful group fails. The group which managed to obliterate all its enemies will fall apart. So, what are we to do about that? See, part of the whole joke of present-day international politics is that the United States, in order with its vast prosperity and enormous facilities for living the lazy life, must have an external enemy to get excited about. And so even though the Cold War is in a way total nonsense, and everybody who's in the know about anything knows it, that, for example, an atomic war between Russia and the United States would simply end the human race. But the populace has to be kept bamboozled. And we keep fighting wars like in Vietnam in order to keep everybody excited and in order to make a fracas and to give the soldiers practice. It's a horrible business. But that's the way things run. And the question is, you see, can we run the human race without awful bloodshed and murders and tortures and all that kind of thing? Can we somehow introduce a new kind of gamesmanship as a substitute for war? It's the same thing in business. Exactly. If you wipe out your competitor, then you have no reason to produce anything but a lousy product. And then you may make lots of money because you wiped out your competitors, you've got the whole market. And then you've got this money, what are you going to buy with it? Well, there's nothing to buy except other people's lousy products who wiped out their competitors. Or who cheated the public by packaging the thing to look elegant but it was nothing inside. That's all you've got to buy. So naturally, if you're a success in General Motors, you go and buy a Rolls Royce from England. Or you go and buy a Mercedes from Germany because they happen to be better cars. Or if you want to make a lot of money in the clothing industry here, making wretched prints, and you want some good clothes, what do? Well, you have to go to Mexico and buy the things peasants wear because they're still substantial, solid, damn good clothes. So you see, there's something always self-defeating in these attempts to succeed. You could say nothing fails like success. So for this reason, then, the Taoist always had an attitude of caution. Cautious, Lao Tzu says, as one who crosses a river in spring. That means either because of the spring floods or because the ice is still there and you're not quite sure how strong it is, because it's beginning to thaw. So, what the Taoist tries to develop is a sensibility to the situation. He tries to feel out intuitively what kind of action is required under these circumstances, because he feels that he can never discover it analytically with his conscious attention alone. Well, now, to talk in modern Western terms about how this is done, we must realize, of course, that we are equipped inside our heads with an absolutely fantastic thing called the brain. With its millions and millions of neuron cells, it is, as it were, the most amazing computer ever devised. Basic to the Taoist attitude to life is that you have that within you, and you may, if you don't know anything about brains very much, call it intuition or something of that kind. But you have within you the most amazing logical analyzer that exists in the known world. And the point is to get it to work for you. And instead of trying with conscious attention alone, which can only think of about three things at a time without using a pencil. That is to say, keep three variables in mind at once. Very few people can do four without using a pencil. You can do four if you're a trained musician, where you're playing four different lines of a fugue, say. You're keeping four variables in mind at once. With an organist, you can go from four to six, because you've got your 2 feet, and they're playing too. But that requires a high amount of training to be able, with conscious attention, to keep these many variables in mind. But the world around us has infinitely many variables going in it. And you can reason out something with your conscious verbal thinking. Say you want to make a contract in business, and you figure out how to make it, whether it will be a good contract, whether it will work, etc., etc. And you think of all these things and write them down, and you make the contract, and you think that's fine. But one of the variables that you couldn't possibly include in the contract was that your partner would slip on a banana skin and break his neck. All sorts of things. I mean, the contract might make provisions in it if your lawyer was thoughtful for what was to be done under the case of the disability of any of the parties thereto, etc. But eventually, there are so many possibilities that can occur that you cannot think of them all. So then the question arises, is it within the power of the human brain to comprehend, because of its immense complexity, in a kind of un- or subconscious way, what the surface consciousness can never grasp? And the Taoist would say, certainly it can. That you've got to learn to use your brain by allowing it to go to work on your problems without interfering with it. And then it will deliver you a decision. And this is why when you get to the real study of Taoist and Zen Buddhist practice, you get to the point where you learn to act without making decisions. Or rather, to use a more exact word, without choosing. Krishnamurti talks a great deal about being choicelessly aware. And he says freedom is precisely the state of not having to choose. Now that sounds quite paradoxical, because we're always talking about freedom of choice. But choice is not a form of freedom in the sense of the word. What is choice in the sense of the word? Choice is the act of hesitation that we make before making a decision. It is a mental wobbling. You know, some people, when they take up a pen to write, they don't just write, but they jiggle the pen around indecisively like this and then start writing. Or a person comes into a room and wonders who to talk to and sort of is in doubt, you see. In that moment, he's choosing. Whereas a person who comes into a room and decides who to approach, he doesn't wait to choose. We say he is decisive, but that's a funny saying, because it means he doesn't stop to decide. So in the training in Zen Buddhism, which is simply a Buddhist extension of Taoism, Zen Buddhism arose out of the marriage of Buddhism and Taoism in the 5th century AD. And over the following centuries. So they have a way of training you so that you always act without choosing. For example, there was one day a leaky roof, and there were a couple of monks attending the Zen master, and he said, the roof is leaking. One monk disappeared and came back instantly with a sieve and put it under the drips. Another monk, after some time, came back with a bucket. And the master praised the one who brought the sieve. Now, the action wasn't exactly appropriate, I mean, you know, to catching rain. But the point was that he was in the spirit of the Zen discipline by acting without choosing. And you will notice this with certain people. Certain people never hesitate. They always seem, if something needs to be done, they seem somehow simply to grab something and do it. You know, which is a kind of a Zen capacity. But so what happens is this, that the teacher of Zen constantly throws curves at his students and puts them in dilemma situations where they have to act immediately. One of the things, of course, that you mustn't do is rush, because rush is a form of hesitation. Rushing, when a person rushes to get a train, he starts to fall over his own feet. See? So it really holds him up. It's like trying to drive at high speed through the water with a blunt-nosed boat. That's rush. But now what he's trying to get is a kind of a smooth, unhesitating, flowing action that is the response to the challenge. And it must be done with what is called another use of this word, mu. This is called wunyan in Chinese, or munen in Japanese. And this word, nen, is composed of the character meaning now and the character meaning mind-heart, shin. And so has the meaning of a thought, but especially for us, it is well translated by the psychological term blocking. You're blocking, you say to someone, when they hesitate, when they dither, when they stop to choose. So the attitude of munen, or wunyan, is the unblocked mind, where it doesn't hesitate ever. Just as the river doesn't hesitate when it flows, and just when you clap your hands, the sound comes out without hesitation. And when the moon rises, the water doesn't wait to reflect it. It reflects it instantly. So that instant reflection, or it's a kind of resonance, is what is looked for as a response of the individual to his environment. And he does this to the degree that he knows himself to be one with his environment. Then his capacity for response increases in according to the way in which he feels that he is simply all of a piece with it, and not something that is in it and with a barrier around him through which messages have to get, and then their decisions have to be made up and sent out. So then, you could say that a kind of extremely subtle sensory awareness has to be developed as between the individual and his environment, so that he feels it out. Now, today, this sort of talk is very unpopular, because scientifically minded people, especially academic scientists, those who teach in universities, are exceedingly suspicious of intuitive reactions. They say, you can get into all sorts of trouble that way. But the thing that they neglect to realize is that everybody uses it. Even the most meticulously careful, analytical, rigorous, sound scientist uses intuitive judgment after a certain point. Why? Because you may accumulate data forever, and you may decide that this is on the whole, and taking all due things into consideration and procedures having been worked out, that this is the right thing to do. Why do you decide then? Mostly because time's up. and somebody's pressing for a decision, or else you are bored to death with bringing in data, because you never know much how much data you need to make a certain decision. And therefore, you may go on collecting data till all is blue, but in the last analysis, you'll work on hunch. And so much is actually, in the end, decided by flipping coins. And the pity of flipping coins for making decisions gives you only two choices, heads or tails, one way or the other. The Chinese have a more subtle way of flipping coins. They have a method of a 64-sided coin to flip, so that instead of just heads or tails, there are 64 possibilities of coming to a decision when you don't know what to do. This is called the I Ching, or the Book of Changes, where the symbols of yang and yin, that is to say, for yang, a straight line, undivided; for yin, a line broken in the middle. There are 64 ways of combining six of these lines in a hexagram. And so there is a complex method when you have to make a grave decision for tossing. You do it by tossing sticks or coins, and it gives you one of these 64 figures. Now, if you are very wise and have studied the Book of Change for a long time, you don't need to use the book. You just look at what the figure is, and you can tell what it means. Because, you see, these figures are made up of each six hexagram figure is made up of two threefold components. That has two components, of which this one is water, and this one is heaven. So you will have water over heaven. And a person very skilled in the interpretation will feel out the meaning of water over heaven. But actually, if you are not so skilled, there is the book. And for each of these hexagrams, the book has an oracle. And it tells you in curiously vague and yet curiously precise terms the meaning of this hexagram. And then you, in the light of your own situation, make up your mind what it's saying to you. In the light of the problem that you've raised, the question that you've asked, the decision that you had to make, you will find invariably that these 64 choices are one of them, or indeed all of them, but you have to pick one of them because you are, after all, tossing a coin. But it has some peculiarly appropriate thing to say to you under your circumstances, and it's just like having a conversation with a very, very wise old gentleman. And you must realize that today in Asia, this book is still widely used for making business and political decisions, although people who are westernized wouldn't let on, perhaps, that they use it. And so anybody who does politics or does business with Asia should be completely versed in this book to know what sort of thinking, what sort of approach might be expected under any circumstances. If you could ever find out what hexagram had fallen when a certain politician had made a decision, it would be immensely enlightening as to his future course of action. In the same way, for example, in dealing with Hitler, our strategists, I don't know if they did, should have been students of astrology, because he was always consulting astrologers. And therefore, astrology would be much more easy to penetrate than the I Ching, because you can know Hitler is looking all the time at his own horoscope. Well, we have access to Hitler's horoscope, and so we know what he's thinking about it. But you don't have access to what hexagram Mao Zedong threw when he decided to do something or other. So it's a little bit more subtle. Well then, I'm making the point then that our scientists are very suspicious of the intuitive judgment. But nevertheless, they all use it in the end. And so it has made this suspicion that science has of intuitive judgment has filtered down to the average person in terms of a mistrust of his own intuition, of the marvelous analytical powers of his own brain. And so we are always in a dither of doubt as to whether we are behaving the right way, doing the right thing, and so on and so forth, and lack a certain kind of self-confidence. And if you see you lack self-confidence, you will make mistakes through sheer fumbling. If you do have self-confidence, you may get away with doing entirely the wrong thing. The British have an enormous degree of self-confidence. They know they're right. And they don't even question it. There are certain kinds of British types who are absolutely, their aplomb is unbelievable. And you can't shake them. I wouldn't dream of it. They're not even defending themselves. They know they're so right. And therefore they can allow any kind of political revolution, total free speech, all sorts of things can go on, which make Americans very nervous because Americans don't have the same degree of aplomb. They're not quite sure, you see. When you're an aristocrat and you've been brought up for generations in the right schools and there's never any doubt whatsoever, you don't even have to mention the fact that you're an aristocrat. See, I mean, that's why aristocrats know how to treat servants. But they never take it out on their servants in the sense of having to emphasize their own superiority. Because they know they're superior. They don't even question it. See? Well, this is an extraordinary kind of nerve that they've built up. And so the only way, you know, you can do this is, first of all, in Zen practice, the thing that you have to understand is this. You have to regard yourself as a cloud in the flesh. Because, you see, clouds never make mistakes. Did you ever see a cloud that was misshapen? Did you ever see a badly designed wave? No, they always do the right thing. Now, so, as a matter of fact, do we, because we are natural beings, just like clouds and waves. Only we have complicated games which cause us to doubt ourselves. But if you will treat yourself for a while as a cloud or wave and realize that you can't make a mistake, whatever you do, because even if you do something that seems to be totally disastrous, it'll all come out in the wash somehow or other. Then, through this capacity, you will develop a kind of confidence. And through confidence, you will be able to trust your own intuition. Only the thing that you have to be careful about is, and many people who have not understood Zen properly fall into trouble here, is that when they take the attitude that I can't possibly make a mistake, they overdo it. Which shows that they don't really believe it. So a lot of people come on and say, well, in Zen, anything goes. You're naturally with it anyway. You are a Buddha anyhow. And I'm going to prove I'm a Buddha anyhow by breaking all the rules. And so you put on the weirdest, filthiest clothes and you go and steal things and all kinds of things like that. That's overdoing it. That shows that you haven't learned. You're overcompensating. Because before you were told to do this, do that, and the other, and watch, and be self-conscious and nervous, and so on. And so you just go to the other extreme. But this is the middle way of knowing it has nothing to do with your decision to do this or not. Whether you decide that you can't make a mistake, or whether you don't decide it, it's true anyway. That you are like cloud and water. And through that realization, without overcompensating in the other direction, you will come to the point where you begin to be on good terms with your own being and to be able to trust your own brain. But at that level, you are supra-personal. That is to say, when you realize that you stand here as a body, it's as if, you see, There was, according to certain cosmological theories today, a primordial explosion which blew up and created the universe. And you know how it is when you take a bottle of ink and you throw it at a whitewash wall, smash like that, and it goes splat all over the place. There's a big blob in the center. And then as it goes out, it gets all sorts of little curlicues and wiggles. So you see, the cosmic explosion is still happening. It takes a long time from that big essential bang for the whole thing to go whoosh. It takes billions of years for it to happen. And it's still happening. And we are the little curlicues out on the edge. See? And we are connected. We are part of the central explosion that originally happened. That, in a certain sense, is in you. You are still manifesting it. You see? So, when you consider yourself as a physical being, consider this hand. It is very ancient. Just like you pick up a stone. Say, how old is this stone? Well, scientists will say, well, it's about, comes from the Pleistocene age, and it's probably, you know, 4 million years old. But then you think, well, wait a minute. You mean 4 million years old? Where did it come from? What was it before it was a stone? Well, it was something or other. And that goes back, you see. So everything you touch, including yourself, is incredibly ancient. Goes back to the very beginning of time. So if your mind awakens, you suddenly see all your friends sitting around you looking incredibly ancient. I don't mean in the sense of old and haggard, but like angels, like eternal beings who were always there from the beginning.